Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Hello.
Hello.
I think we must just have students.
Hey, well, welcome everybody. I hope you guys are doing great. I hope this is not interfering with your Thanksgiving week for those of you in the U.S. I really appreciate all the responses and the feedback and especially the questions that I'm continuing to get. I wanted to pick a couple especially that kind of may set the tone for what we're going to be talking about this evening. I'm leaving this on discussion mode, so if you'll manage the background noise because I'd like to get a response or any thoughts or questions before we begin the actual seminar. The comments have been, or the questions really have been about, you know, how can you prime your mind and brain to prepare for an anticipated situation and establish a mindset of confidence, for example. So I wanted to share a couple of thoughts about this. Here's how not to do it. Remember, we don't talk about the negative in coaching. We don't talk about problems, but I wanted to talk about how not to do it. This is from Alexander Wolf in Sports Illustrated. By yelling at his point guard for missing that wide open teammate in the corner, a coach has probably ensured that it will happen again. So again, we get what we focus on. Think about those of you who have played the game Taboo. You have a target word on a card that you've drawn that you want your partner to say, given your single word clues that you can't accompany by gestures. I know most of you guys have played this. Also on that card with the target word are about a half dozen words that you cannot use, the words that would make it too easy, because if you use these words, you lose the point. The idea here is often what you should not say frames and dominates thinking, if it is like it for me, to get beyond the taboo words to offer reasonable clues. That's how most of our minds and brains work. That's how your clients cannot focus on anything other than problems. They're looking at those taboo words. They've got those down. Those are familiar. So a common perception. Can I get a mute on the background noise, please, to be able to remain on discussion mode? Even if you're barely whispering, it's picked up. Even if you're moving paper, it's barely picked up. So a common perception is the best way to get employees or players to perform is pointing out mistakes or making threats or being intense, but it works just the opposite. We know from conversational intelligence, we touched on this before, the first few words you use with someone boots up a particular mindset that processes the remainder of the conversation. If those words are ones of collaboration, which is exactly what we do in coaching, then the remainder of the conversation is mediated by the entire neurochemical system of oxytocin, of bonding, and I'm gonna move us to a lecture mode, because some of you have an uncontrollable cough out there, so hold on. So that boots up a mindset that's mediated by oxytocin, the chemical of bonding and connection. If the first few words are perceived as pejorative, judgmental, critical, then the mindset is mediated by the neurochemical system of protection, of dealing with threat. So it processes the entire remainder in a very different way. And here's one just very brief case vignette that will illustrate this to hopefully make it helpful in your coaching practice, because I know a number of you have mentioned about wanting like case examples. I'm going to tell you about a client I'll call Jana. Jana was a professional coach doing mentor coaching with me to enhance her skills and jumpstart her practice. She had a stellar background as a therapist prior to making the transition to professional coaching, and had just gone through a near-miss hurricane experience in her home in Florida. She was exhausted and depleted because she was unable to say no to all the people who she knew who needed help. If I see someone in need, I help them. I feel bad if I don't help. I'm not able to not do something for them. And I get overextended and exhausted so that I'm not able to do even necessary things for myself, my family, or my clients. Now, we know from neuroscience, this is a sidebar, that how you label a feeling determines the mindset that you boot up to process. In this instance, Jana indicated that she said no, that she thought. If she said no to someone she perceived in need, She felt guilty, and she framed a whole cascade of responses that resulted in her feeling depleted. And we discussed the simple concept of framing. This is called cognitive reappraisal. This is not something I talked about with her, but I'm talking about this with you conceptually. This is the principle of accurately labeling a feeling so that the correct mindset is booted up to process everything that follows. So, back to talking with a real person. If you label an experience like saying no as guilt, then that's going to engage a whole series of responses that result from feeling guilty. We then talked about a more accurate labeling of her experience than calling it guilt, because she hadn't done anything wrong. I mean, Carl Menninger said, save guilt for real sin. There wasn't anything on the horizon with her. She was very benevolent and loving and giving. And saying no meant that she considered, could mean that she considered available possibilities and resources, and that she had a commitment to her own purposeful agenda. In other words, no simply could mean that she was loyal to her agenda and her commitments, not reactively responding to others. So this simple reframing resulted in a loyalty and effectiveness to her own ideals and needs, moving the point of reference back to her needs, her ideals, as a proactive way of looking at it, rather than reactive of everybody who wanted something from her and feeling guilty if she didn't do it. Simply accurately relabeling what was for her a stressful response allowed her to have a balanced decision in keeping her own needs and ideals and goals in perspective. Because basically, every yes you have to pay for with at least one no. So how you label something determines how you're going to proceed with it. So that's something that I wanted to share with you that kind of moves us in the direction of talking about mindset. So the other question, very related, and I want to just do this briefly, how can mental framing determine even outcome, or at least how somebody proceeds? So think about this question. Don't think of an elephant. Now, that statement, that question, is the title of a book by Dr. George Lakoff, a social scientist, social psychologist. It ensures you're going to think about an elephant. Whether the focus is negative or positive, it activates the imagery of an elephant. Remember, neuroscience and quantum physics show us we get what we focus on, not what we want. The focus can be determined in a number of ways to either enhance or detract from performance. So what we think about, how we frame something, determines the mindset that we boot up to deal with it. A mindset is like a software program. And the belief, here's the equation. We've touched on this before. Beliefs drive behavior. Behavior drives performance. Whatever belief we activate will determine our behavior. The behavior determines performance. So that's why we think about, as we talked about before, looking at possibility rather than problem. How we look at something determines the mindset we boot up. And again, to reiterate, our brains can't tell the difference between anxiety and excitement. If we frame it as excitement, we move ahead and look for possibilities, look for ways to engage, and ways to experience effectiveness and mastery. So, thanks for all the responses, all the questions that you've sent in. I'm going to go ahead and move into our seminar now while I'm still on lecture mode, and I promise to save some time at the end for discussion. So we're going to talk about, as I mentioned, mindset mapping. And you have the detail of this. I'll primarily stick a little bit more to the outline than I did before. And recall from last seminar, a state of mind is like a software program that determines what we perceive, how we then process information, and how we respond. So we're constantly monitoring and interpreting things to give us a running account of what happens, what it means, what to do. This is how we stay on track or how we get stuck. Mindsets frame the ongoing account of how we interpret, process, and then decide to act. Our mindsets contain the beliefs that we operate on. And remember, I mentioned that beliefs as well as facts are anatomical realities in our brain. So we have to come to recognize these and have a strategic way to begin a change and transformation. In fact, researchers at Norwegian University of Science and Technology recently discovered that the brain creates multiple independent maps while we react in the world each day. The human brain, in other words, operates very much like a Google map. Instead of one giant map where you're always in a flow, the brain makes a whole series of maps to operate. When a new situation arises, a new map is booted up. This explains how we have different contexts or frames for different situations and how important the frame is each time. So we have different states of mind or mindsets. That also emphasizes how important it is to have a superordinate story that we understand, to organize this, to make sense of it, and to make sense of the flow and to create a sense of continuity. The mindset comes first. A state of mind determines the meaning that we attach to any cue or stimulus. The meaning determines your behavior. So, to change your behavior, change the meaning you attach. So, let's look first at mind maps, the brain's story. The brain connections, or mind maps, influence the reality that we see. A paradigm, it's roughly synonymous with a mind map, is a model. It's a theory or frame of reference. It's simply the way we see the world. What we perceive, understand, and interpret is our individual paradigm, our map. And remember, we got a bunch of maps, a bunch of Google maps. The paradigm is the map that explains the territory. It's not the territory itself. So with the right map, planning and strategy can make a huge difference. And each of us has a number of maps or paradigms in our head, our storylines. We're often unaware of having them, assuming that we just see things the way they are. And remember, we talked earlier, your clients don't assume they're writing a story or have a story. They're just telling you the way it is. These paradigms, the way we see things, determine how we structure meaning, how we think, and how we behave. So it's useful to be able to self-reflect, and especially to see which ones work and which ones don't. We originally construct beliefs to make sense of our experiences in the world. Then those beliefs become predictors and then confirm the reality that generates them. So here's an illustration of that. Some of you have heard me say this story before. This is a true story out of Oxford a number of years ago. Two anthropologists were chosen to enter separate, essentially identical ape colonies to live and observe for a year. They didn't know what each other was doing, didn't communicate, and they were chosen because they had remarkable similarities of personality, philosophy, training, education. After a year, they both emerged to compare notes. The ape colonies were controlled as much as possible. They expected similarities, but instead found remarkable discrepancies. One anthropologist, after an initial period of transition, was accepted by the ape colony, integrated, and achieved a unity and a comfort with the apes, got remarkable data. The other anthropologist never got beyond the social periphery of his colony. He was always careful and vigilant, always right on the cusp of a conflict, never achieved that harmony or comfort. The anthropologist could not understand the very different results or find any reason. They puzzled for months. They and their teams puzzled for several months. until they finally found one difference. The anthropologist, who was the uncomfortable, careful outsider, had a gun. Now, the gun never showed, he never used it, the apes never knew he had it, but he knew he had it. He knew if things got tough, he had an out. The anthropologist who had no gun had a commitment. He had a different belief. From the beginning, he would either make it or not on his own. And in retrospect and reconstruction, each of their assumptions, their belief systems, created the reality that they experienced. We tell our story, then our story tells us. A belief is a feeling of certainty about what something means. If you want to ask somebody about their belief, ask, well, how do you know that? And as coaches, we listen for limiting beliefs that ghostwrite behaviors, unconscious biases, inattention blindness, the various things that may get in the way that may be part of those algorithms in that unconscious operating system somebody's not even aware of, but there's evidence in the end result, the behavior. Now, a map reduces the size and complexity of a territory. It's sort of our concept of an understanding that rather than each situation being overwhelming or chaotic or a new experience, we can shift to an organizing frame of reference, a mind map. We help a client choose the most effective mind map even. We relate it to something we know, which can suggest certain options. One of our uniquely human qualities is self-awareness, the ability to reflect on how we think and what we do. Having this ability, we can learn from both our experiences and from those of others. This is why we can create a new story and why we can be aware if we place the new into the container of the old, a repetition. We are not our old story. We created our old story. We are not our habits or thoughts. We can think about things, reflect on them, examine our paradigms to see if they still serve us as well or if there would be something better. Now, a dilemma means having two or more mental maps in conflict. So this is one application of coaching that can involve two levels. At a macroscopic level, selecting the mental map that's most productive for a given task, or even developing a new meta map. Here's an example. Someone feels anxious and uncomfortable about trying something new that would be a change. We help them correctly read the anxiety or the uncertainty of a new endeavor as validation of moving ahead beyond a comfort zone, rather than in an old model as a signpost of danger, better head for cover. In other words, we help them frame opportunity, excitement, rather than anxiety, problem, danger. At a microscopic level, the awareness of the choices of this moment and picking the best one. So the example is the brief case vignette that I gave you. If you label something wrong, you're going to write the wrong story. You'll use the wrong map. If you feel bad saying no and label it as guilt, you're going to use a different map than if you see it as setting an appropriate boundary where no means no and you're taking care of yourself. Here's another example of a conflicting mindset. A client of mine, an attorney, was asked by her dad, "I'd like you to be the executor of my estate." His daughter, my client, said, "Well, sure, Dad. First, I'll need to know some basic things about your property and wishes." And he said, "That's none of your business." That's a conflicting mindset. Remember, the map is not the territory. That is, beliefs are not reality, at least not consensual reality. Beliefs are the negotiations we construct to deal with the subjective realities that we each experience. So we need to recognize that we each create our own stories so that we can take ownership in order to assess what needs to change, what needs to be enhanced, and what just simply needs to be ignored. So, to map a new story and navigate with the brain's error detection mechanism, Let's look at that just a bit. Our brains create patterns of connections as we continue always to search for meanings. Our brain is a pattern recognition organ. These patterns, mental maps, relate to our ability to plan and predict the future. What is it, for example, as a total sidebar here, that makes Tom Brady so great? It's his ability to instantly recognize defensive patterns and know instinctively what to do. And that does not occur in the prefrontal cortex. It occurs from having deliberate practice and exceptional experience over time. So, discomfort and uncertainty begin any significant journey. Our brains even have an error detection mechanism. It's located very close to the emotional center that says this isn't normal when we try something new. So what this means practically, every client you have in every situation where they do something new and different, and ideally that's going to be every session with you, probably multiple times, is going to be accompanied by some uncertainty, anxiety, trepidation, just not being sure. I think we need to empathically resonate with that so that the client knows that we get that this is new and different, because then we can help them frame this uncertainty or trepidation in a new way. This is validation that you're in new territory. This is expectable because our brains are wired to want to repeat something. Even we have a brain error detection mechanism that says this isn't right, this isn't what I expect. So the error detection mechanism, not that we're going to teach clients this, and again, I want to respond to some of the questions here just briefly. We don't do training or teaching of a client. We don't give information. All of this information, all the way I talk to you, is not a way I talk to clients. This is all for your knowledge to incorporate into the collaborative conversation with a client. So back to the error detection mechanism. This is an actual center in the brain that fires when something is not a predictable pattern. We notice differences more easily than confirmation, so it becomes easier to focus on the things we do wrong while struggling to list our strengths. The brain error detection mechanism is activated, and something that's activated gets more attention. It energizes. If advice is unfamiliar or unwanted, it sets off the error detection response, meaning that somebody can reject an idea before they even consider it. And that places another barrier to resist change. This is why telling a client what to do often doesn't work. It triggers the error detection mechanism. Also, this mechanism focuses on problems, which energizes because it activates the error detection mechanism. That's why the 5 o'clock news is compelling. If it bleeds, it leads. That's why a wreck on a freeway gets our attention, because it's different. It breaks the monotony. So the mental maps that were tailor-made for a certain context in our lives, such as stress or childhood, may simply not apply in situation now. Now, this hardwiring is not permanent. It can be reversed. When changes occur in a systematic and consistent way, and this is what we're going to talk about right now, such as with collaborative contingent conversations, new connections are made in the brain. New maps are created. So this is how the brain's error detection mechanism can be used as a part of a powerful internal navigation system. So here are 10 principles of how the brain operates to facilitate change. 1, change generates discomfort. And part of this resistance to change is due to something far more challenging than just getting someone to decide to do differently. Any attempt to modify behavior and habits requires an actual rewiring of the brain. So anything that we repeat, that we do repeatedly, become hardwired. They become habits, neuronal pathways and neural networks, the highways and villages in our brains have become etched by repeated habits to create an efficient operation to make routine behaviors easy. So basically, we don't have to think about the way we drive to work each day. Remember that back pre-COVID? Because of this default mode, we can think about other things or listen to a book. And this default mode is energy efficient because the brain's freed up to do other things. Now, when it's disrupted, like there's construction, you have to think about it. You can't really pay attention to the audiobook. So when these habits are confronted to change, as we do in coaching, the automatic pilots in the midbrain get disrupted. We feel discomfort when that happens. The prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain, has to get busy with more energy and attend to thinking more. And that's not the function that it was wired for. It was wired for evolutionary ease to make it easy so you could think about other things. So basically, it's work to change. The natural inclination is to resist the stress of change to preserve the default habit. And the brain naturally resists change because hardwiring saves energy. So to change opposes for the brain what's been adaptive from an evolutionary sense. Now, the promise of change is to develop a new, better default mode. The brain just doesn't know that yet, so our minds have to lead the way. Some remarkable new research shows that consistently repeating new experiences even alters gene expressions. Beliefs can simply turn genes on or turn them off, we now know. And I've heard him say this in person. Ray Kurzweil, and he's written about this in The Singularity is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology. He put it very simply. Civilization advances by extending the number of important operations which we can perform without thinking about them. And what one of the great philosophers of the 20th century said, I like things I don't have to think about. George Costanza. 2, change creates dissonance. We see what we expect to see, what our radar has been coded for. In fact, when we don't see what we expect, that's when the error detection mechanism fires. Since this portion of your brain has the job description to recognize and correct errors, consider, for example, the emotional expense of a couple of things. One is a lie. The surface story is the constructed lie. The subliminal story is the recognition of the lie by the error detection mechanism. Then you have to deal with the dissonance. So it's triple work to lie. Another, debt. The real expense of buying something you can't afford is you have to pay more for it. Then the emotional expense in the dissonance in your brain, because the error detection mechanism reads that you spent money you didn't have, you couldn't afford to buy. So then you have to pay interest on the debt, triple work again. You can deceive others, even your own mind, but your brain always knows. Now, the good news, this neural machinery can both recognize and correct errors to optimize behavior. So we respond to mistakes. Now, this is great if we remember to discern whether it's a mistake or simply a neural response and printout to change itself. And we'll return to this in a few minutes when we talk about mapping change. 3, the brain is a prediction machine. Let me give you some numbers. If you have a pen, write these down. 1, 2, 4, 5, 7, 8. What's missing? One answer is probably 3 and 6, maybe even multiples of 3. Consider this. Nothing's missing. I gave you a complete set, a list of 6 numbers. Everything that's there is there. What's missing, if you thought it was, is inside your head, informed by a pattern of expectation. Now, this is huge in writing a new story. Sometimes you have to outsmart your brain. When anything recurs two times in a row, the brain predicts a third repetition. A stock goes up two quarters in a row, so the brain predicts a third rise will follow. J. Paul Getty said that there are three key elements to getting rich. Get up early, work hard, find oil. You can see how the brain prediction of pattern is the basis of a number of jokes, listing two things, then a third non sequitur, set up, payoff. The human brain automatically imposes patterns and predictions on repeated events. This makes it a challenge to override at times both emotion and brain patterns to make wise and balanced decisions. 4. Behavioral reinforcements can backfire. Let's say you're COO of a company determining a policy about employees being on time. Which do you think works better, threats or reinforcements? The answer is neither. Both are likely to backfire. Studies show a couple of things. Threats work short-term but draw attention away from work and back to the problem that created the behavior, like the coach that I gave example of moments ago. It focuses on the negative. And recognition for someone being on time actually can increase anxiety and reinforce the neural patterns connected with lateness, the positive way to focus on lateness. So, same result. We assume people will receive information about change and use it to better themselves. Not so, says the brain. The error detection mechanism reads, well, this isn't right. And being told what to do results in an innate opposition. The brain, at one level, responds like a two-year-old with a pushback. The brain's natural homeostasis says, avoid change. 5, and I think this is going to be huge. This is huge and will be useful in coaching. Motivation is not essential. How many times have you heard, those of you at CTA in the coach to coach session, well, I just need to get motivated. I need to lose weight. I need to get motivated to do a better diet. And that launches the coach to coach session. Well, I'm here to tell you, someone does not have to be motivated to do something, to change, to create a new habit. Somebody may not even generate motivation in the beginning or throughout. Many of the professional athletes and actors I've worked with get up in the morning, they go to the gym, they are not motivated to do it. But they do it because they know they need to do that in order to do what's next. Motivation isn't essential. There are only two things essential. Having a plan and sticking to it. Now, the plan, as we know in coaching, has to be specific, structured. It has to be very clear about what the next step is. But a plan and sticking to it, that's all you need. You don't have to be motivated. For example, you don't have to be motivated to save for retirement. Just set up an automatic payment or participation plan. You only have to make one decision, one good choice, one time. You have X amount of money withdrawn or, you know, moved from your checking account to your retirement account each month, forever, or until you retire. One decision. 6, emotions change brain functioning. When emotions are triggered, brain chemicals of dopamine and adrenaline especially are released that prompt toward action and away from creativity and even assessing knowledge. This is why self-talk is limited. One of the philosophers of the 21st century put it this way. Everybody has a plan till they get punched in the mouth. That was Mike Tyson. When there's a possibility of a reward, dopamine is released to produce an excited state in response to anticipating a reward, a risky stock investment, approaching a slot machine, or a blackjack table. Here's what we know now. it's not the reward that causes the spike in dopamine. That's what we thought in science for a long, long time. It's the anticipation of reward. For example, when gamblers were studied and they were hooked up to an fMRI, their excitement occurred as they approached the slot machine, not when they won. It was before they ever touched the slot machine. Their increased brain firing and dopamine was the anticipation of a reward. Same thing with spending money. It's the anticipation of doing. It's not what you get. It's not actually giving them. Same with eating. This is a total sidebar, and I won't take that long. Back in the days when I was a shrink, I finally learned to ask this question of people who had eating disorders. I had a huge program and developed some research for eating disorders. And I learned to ask, at what point in the process of, like, using food symptomatically, like bulimia, at what point in the process does your state change? 100% of the people who use food symptomatically, like bulimics, would recognize actually before the food ever touched my mouth. They realized that the food was a prop in a process. I didn't know the neuroscience of it at the time, but the process was very telling and very important, that the food was a prop in a process. Even an unnecessary prop. So, research shows that the anticipation of reward can be more satisfying than actually receiving it, because receiving it shuts down this engine of anticipation and the high that goes with it. That's why people are often disappointed in not being as excited about something as they thought they'd be, that they've been wanting a long time, and have buyer's remorse, or something is just not what they thought it would be, because their neurochemical system has shifted from the anticipation of dopamine, the pleasure chemical, to the marathon chemical of norepinephrine, which is to sustain something. So it contributes to all of the experiences of something not being as exciting as we anticipated to be, especially the new purchase that you've been waiting a long time for. Seven. See, I just saved you guys some money there for that BMW you've been thinking. Seven, stimulation and performance. Now, stimulation is also known as a little bit of stress. It enhances memory and learning. Things that excite us provide a little bit of stress short term can enhance learning. The time window on this is up to 2 hours. For longer periods of time, especially 4 hours or more, things can go the other direction. Learning capacity declines. So this means that with sustained stress, people can make bad emotionally charged decisions. So the most important success strategy for most of the clients, especially professional performing and practicing professionals, regulation of states of mind, and management of emotions. 8, closure to novelty. Studies show that even highly accomplished people can close themselves to novelty as they get older. Now, the major factor is not their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, such as been in a certain business. People who stay in one place, in one position, can get most entrenched. An example of one place that I see this is the family succession of business. The patriarch founder passes the company that he founded 36 years ago to his two children to own and manage. It's a challenge because everyone involved has to change roles, relationships, positions, duties, and the wiring of their brains are to keep repeating the same thing. Not that they're resisting, but it's just that's the way we're wired. Now, these last two principles I think are especially huge for mentor coaching. 9. Neurogenesis is the creation of new brain cells. Here's how that happens. 2 things above all others create neurogenesis. An enriched environment, which is exactly what we do with our clients. We are catalysts to stimulate, to co-create. The other is exercise. So an enriched environment of intellectual and emotional stimulation creates more complex brain structure to stimulate thinking, to challenge, to story bust, to co-create. The hippocampus is the part of the brain that's especially connected with 2 things, creativity and memory. Mice from an enriched environment have a 15% increase in the number of their hippocampal cells. Exercise increases the number, the actual number of cells in the hippocampus almost 100%. And these studies have been replicated more recently in non-invasive human studies in London taxicab drivers and University of Hamburg medical students. Another related finding, what causes the number of cells in the hippocampus to go down? What impairs neurogenesis? Chronic stress. And 10, the other major factor, neuroplasticity simply means that the brain remodels itself. This has been called the scientific revolution of our time. A region of the brain that originally had one job can be trained to perform another. In other words, the brain can reassign job descriptions of neurons. It's like rezoning and developing cortical real estate. You know, for example, the area, the portion of the brain that is devoted to the fingers that are used in Braille significantly expand the brain region area. Same with classical guitar. Now, here's an example. When we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. Some NASA astronauts did a training experiment in which they had headgear with a visual apparatus that reversed the image. Up was down, down was up. Everything was absolutely, totally reversed 24 hours a day. So the astronauts had to respond by proceeding very carefully, slowly. They had to think about everything before they did it. Then they noticed at day 25, they were in this headgear for 24 hours a day. Day 25, they noticed something remarkable. Their brains automatically had made the adjustments. They had rewired. The brains developed new neural pathways. Now, another group of astronauts in the headgear were given a day off out of the helmets for 24 hours at day 15. When they put the headgear back on, it took them 25 days from that point on to make the adjustments. That's the role of consistency. So the human brain creates patterns of connections in our ongoing search for meaning. These patterns, our mental maps, plural, relate to our ability to plan and predict the future. When our predictions get repeatedly confirmed, patterns become automatic, so we don't have to think about them anymore. The patterns become hardwired and automatic. So let's look now. In our remaining discussion time, or seminar time, then discussion, the 6 elements, 6 crucial elements to map change, because I want to talk about how to understand and incorporate each of these. 1, we already talked about last seminar, regulate states of mind, because states of mind are like software programs. And the state of mind determines what program is booted up, and that determines what meaning is attached, what we do. It's internally consistent. When someone's in an emotional state, they may be overbalanced toward right brain response, feeling brain. In extreme stress, the emotional brain can even hijack the intellectual logical brain and hold it hostage. So, in any altered state, or just in any situation, before you receive your call, each time from your client, get grounded and centered. Get balanced so that there's access to all states of mind, all of your mind-brain synthesis and integration. So the brain equation for good decisions, right brain emotional, left brain logical, intellectual, equals balanced decision. Now that's an way overly simplified way of looking at it, but it's simply a way of talking about it, about getting balanced, centered, grounded, and having access to all states of mind, because that's where the optimum self-reflective function occurs. The number two element to map changes, the power is in the focus. This, as we've discussed before, is the neuroscience and quantum physics behind the law of attraction. Thoughts have a frequency, an energy field. Focus selects that frequency. All the channels of radio or satellite TV are available. We choose the channel, the frequency we want, out of hundreds of possibilities. We each transmit and receive a frequency through our thoughts. So if you want to change something in your life, change the frequency, change your thoughts. Now, the bad news is if you think about what you don't want, it keeps showing up over and over because you're focusing on it. This concept offers explanation at a brain level for why a solution focus, which is what we do in coaching, is more effective than a problem focus, to look at challenges as possibilities rather than problems, even trying to figure out why the problems are there or what to do differently or create a better solution this time around. These brain connections literally then become new mind maps and can influence how we proceed. We become what we think about, so put energy into what you want. Possibilities rather than problems. Desires instead of obstacles. To fight something is to engage it. Play to win rather than play not to lose. 3, visualize changes. A prototype study that began work in this area, basketball players at Ohio State were divided into 3 groups to practice shooting free throws. One group, no practice for a month. Another group, 30 minutes of practice daily for 30 days. And a third group, they practiced imagining shooting perfect free throws, nothing but net, for at least 5 minutes a day for 30 days. They were tested at the end of 30 days. The first group, no practice, no improvement. Second group, actual practice, 30 minutes a day, 24% improvement. Third group, practice by visualization only, 23% improvement. Now, that has evolved, that actual visualization only, because you don't have to self-correct each time you make a miss, can be even more effective, because practice doesn't make perfect. Practice makes permanent. We know that now in neuroscience. Only perfect practice makes perfect. So create a vision, an image of your goal, then look back to see the path to get there. Visualization crystallizes possibility into an articulated idea. The whole experience changes the brain. So a vision can serve as guide and inspiration when you find ways to realize it, to live into it. 4, insight changes the brain. The moment of insight, an aha experience, a complex set of new neural connections is created. 3 different parts of the brain light up on fMRI scans during these moments, these aha moments, because someone then, because of the neurochemicals involved, are vaulted into a state of greater synthetic, creative, and integrative capacity. Consider when there's no moment of insight, somebody's given instruction, orders, facts, information. nothing happens. No part of the brain lights up. 5, take action. Put it in an output channel. I think I mentioned a very basic prototype, fairly recent study. University of Waterloo did a study, 2 different groups of people, each read the same passage in a book. One read it out loud, one read it silently. They were each given tests. The ones that read it out loud performed 40% better on the test than the ones who read it silently. So here's the practical aspect. The world will not pay you for what you know. It'll pay you for what you do. It rewards action. So this is why a group of the brightest people anywhere with all kind of degrees can plan and figure something out, but maybe struggle to make it happen. Meanwhile, the guy who finished the second semester barely of community college owns a bunch of real estate on the west side of town. Put it in an output channel. And 6, finally, transform identity. A new experience or idea has to be focused on consistently and frequently. When attention is consistent, brain circuitry is stabilized. The mindset of identity then incorporates the new experience and integrates it as part of an evolving self, as part of an identity. To say that differently, one of the most powerful forces of the human psyche is we always return to our core identity, to who we are. Now, if you help a client create change or a change in behavior, unless they see that, unless they incorporate that and transform it into an evolving model of themselves, an evolving identity, they'll revert back to where they were before. So here's a summary concept. Some specific principles to help clients change behavior, minds, and brains. Begin where the client is. Help them learn more about what they already know. Highlight positive attributes, existing neuronal networks, like natural talents, behaviors, patterns, because that aligns with what they already know and where they are. Don't focus on mistakes. Focus will enhance the neuronal etching, so it should be on useful habits. Correct mistaken couplings. Understand and build on existing networks. So basically, let sleeping dogs and old unuseful networks lay. Encourage clients to develop their own connections, their own metaphors, stories, analogies, metaphors. Create their maps. The brain has an intrinsic desire to create novel situations. It rewards newness of thinking at the same time that it opposes it. This is the dilemma. This is the dialectic you go through with every client. The client has to recognize and take ownership of experiences. It doesn't just happen. And when we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. So, finally, give attention to a new experience, a new way of doing things, consistently and repetitively. So, if you guys will manage the background noise, we're in conversation mode. Questions, thoughts, clarifications, what would be helpful to talk a bit more about?
Hi, this is Shakina.
Go ahead, please. Yes.
Yes, I had a question about when you talked about how the brain
Okay, manage the background noise. I can take the question and go back on mute, but I'd like to keep it open, please. Go ahead, please. I'm sorry. Start over with your question.
Okay. Number 6, about emotions change brain functioning under how the brain operates.
Uh-huh.
You mentioned self-talk and how it's limited in its impact.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Talk more about what specifically?
About self-talk and how it's limited when it comes to the emotions and changing brain function.
It's self-talk can be really enhanced. I work with athletes who learn how to do self-talk, to have performance cues, words that may boot up an entire performance mindset. It's important to recognize if there's any negative self-talk, to recognize it as quickly as possible and engage in what is self-directed neuroplasticity. This is just a fancy way to say, let's get it right. So anything that comes up, and this is how our brains work. We're going to have negative self-talk. We're going to have things that are negative thoughts or ideas or I can't do this. Recognize this automatic repetition of your brain, which repeats something that you're familiar with, first recognizing as an error message from your brain. It may have had a context and a relevance earlier in time, but right now it's an error message from your brain, so that you can, as soon as you label it as an error message, meaning your brain is just doing its thing, reframe and refocus on exactly what you want. This can be self-corrected in a matter of seconds. So if it's negative self-talk, then error message from your brain, refocus on what you do want, and have a to-do list along with the to-don't. The negative self-talk, the negative doubts of confidence, all of that, that's the to-don't list. Work on what you do want so you can immediately go to that. Does that help? Is that an answer to your question?
It does. Thank you.
Okay, super. Great. Other thoughts or questions?
I do. How does the neuroplasticity relate to those individuals who are on the autistic spectrum, like those individuals who are aspergic? Are they capable of making those new neural pathways?
Yes, they are. It takes an understanding and a different framework. My daughter in Boston has an entire program for autism spectrum kids and their families. It's more, and they are just as adaptable, but in a different way. It may not be the subtlety of emotion, because this is where the focus has been elsewhere, but it is definitely on behavior. In fact, as I understand, some of the best mechanisms and some of the best strategies, programs, have developed ways to respond to various kinds of behaviors that socially engage, but in a different way. So it's a resounding yes. Look at the there's a little bit of an explanation. It's called the FUSE program, Foundation for Understanding Social Engagement. That's my daughter's program in Boston. They're doing some amazing stuff with school and camps and therapy and stuff. There's kind of an explanation of what they do there that can be adaptable. There are coaches who I know who have developed ways to work with, say, Asperger's clients who have had a very successful and a very meaningful practice. So it's a resounding yes, but you have to know a different system in terms of the brain works a different way. You just have to take it into account. Everybody's brain is unique, but there are some systematic ways of doing things. Remember I mentioned at the very beginning, if you want to change something, focus on the system. This is a superordinate system that will need to be taken into account, because there are some very special qualities that need to be addressed that can make it just as much a success as anyone with any other kind of challenges, including me and you. Okay? Yeah, great question. Thank you. Other clarification? We've got just a minute or two. Anything else?
I have a quick question. Hi, my name is Jennifer.
Welcome.
Hi. So I'm looking at the neuroplasticity, and you mentioned 25 days with the astronauts, and then I'm looking at the visualized changes practice, and you mentioned 30 days that study with the visualization of the basketball players and the free throw shots. So I'm looking at, like, how many times do people need to repeat, you know, the new pattern?
Okay, it's a good question. Yeah. Now, like, there's a spectrum. There's a continuum.
Yeah.
Like the example of the astronauts. That's for a simple behavioral response, a simple cause and effect. And the 25 to 30 days to create a new habit, that's usually for simple, straightforward stuff. Now, the kinds of things that are more subtle, that involve patterns and complexity, that often needs to be engaged for a longer period of time before it hardwires. But the good news there is if you mess up and go back to a usual way of doing things, you don't have to start back at square one. You just self-correct and move ahead. But it can take longer. So it's not a lockstep 25 or 30 days. So that needs to be taken into account. Now, there is a systematic way to look at creating a vision and the affirmations, which are the software, the story that supports the vision. The vision is rewiring your brain. There's a systematic way of going about that. I've forgotten. Did I put that chapter in your resource guide? I think there's a portion of your resource guide that has a systematic way to do that. If not, I'll send it to you because I think it's useful to think about that, because sometimes for some clients it's helpful to help them to create a vision. But most systematic application here also, I know we're over time and I'll stop in 1 second, is to have a complete visualization of a successful attainment of a goal, repeat that vision at the end of each day, beginning of a new day. To hardwired. Thanks. If there are other things that come up, shoot me an email, and I'll check to be sure that you guys have. It's a chapter in a much earlier book that I did called "Outsmart Your Brain: An Instruction Manual." It's a chapter on the old art and the neuroscience of creating a vision. I'll be sure you have a copy of it one way or another. So. We'll pick up right here next time for our final seminar. And thanks again for all the feedback and questions. Very helpful. Have a great Thanksgiving.
Thank you. You
thank
too.
Thank you. You thank too you. As well. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving. Bye, everyone.
Yeah.